You're listening to KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline on this lovely March Friday or Monday morning if you're listening to our rebroadcast at 8 a.m.
I have one thing to say. Spring's coming.
Yeah, I have something to say that goes along with that. Here comes the mud.
The mud, yeah. We already had some mud out here in the parking lot. Yeah.
I think we're really in for it this year with the mud. That's.
I was just asking myself, which is worse, mud or ice? Definitely ice.
Yeah, although, you know, I used to live on a gravel road, and the gravel,
I
when it
too.
Gets muddy, it actually can be almost as slippery as ice.
That's
it can
true.
Pull you over.
You can slide over, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's pretty tricky.
True.
So, but if you fall down in the mud, it doesn't hurt as much.
Yeah, right. That's right.
So,
and I have done that, too.
So, Caroline, what have you been reading this week?
Well, this week I've been reading, of course, Master Your Workday Now by Michael Lindenberger, and it's really fascinating. It really is. And, of course, I don't have an office job or anything because I'm retired, but I still have my to-do list, and I, right away, as soon as I read that first part of that book, I sat down and did my to-do list.
Well, Michael, welcome to Writer's Voices.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I'm going to give a little intro to our guest today, Michael Lindenberger. He's called the efficiency guru by business leaders and the media for his revolutionary common sense approach to workplace productivity. Michael's been a sought-after management consultant and technology professional for more than 20 years. And as a renowned international speaker and seminar leader, he's considered an expert on workday efficiency and task and email management. He's been featured in numerous business magazines, including Fast Company and Investor's Business Daily, both of which I read. Lindenberger is the author of four top-selling productivity books, and his most recent book that we're discussing today is Master Your Workday Now from New Academy Publishers, and it just came out this month, right, Michael?
That's right. Just came out.
Well, we're hot off the press.
Well, tell us a little bit about how you got involved in writing this type of book.
Well, I was working in this huge management consultancy firm called Accenture and managing very big projects. And even though we did a really good job at getting the projects done and completed, the staff on the client side always seemed to be completely disorganized, burned out, and not really able to contribute as much as we hoped that they would contribute to their own projects. And I decided I was going to try to help solve that. And so I worked on some things to try to get ahead of email, get ahead of all the deluge of things that so many of us get every day. You know, we think we've got enough time to do something, and then we realize that we've got about a half day's worth of email to answer as well, and the day just goes right out the door. So I found some solutions, and I've been teaching them, and they work great. So I wrote a book about it.
That's the way to go. Share your knowledge with the world. I mean,
yeah, you know. Definitely. And you know, the books that I've this is my fourth book on the topic, and people really like this, and they need it, as you know. I've each of my books has become a bestseller in its category. I've got the best number one best-selling Microsoft Outlook book, which is using some of these particular techniques to get ahead, and just so much interest in this area. So the new book that I just released quickly went to become the number one time management book on Amazon, and so we're roaring out there, and people like this.
When was your first book published, Michael?
Back in 2004.
Well, four books
wow.
in 6 years. That's
amazing.
Pretty productive.
Yeah, I say.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you said that. I was feeling a little slow.
No, oh my gosh, you must use your own techniques to get organized.
No,
right?
I like to do about a book every 2 years, to one to two years. That's my plan.
So you have more in the hopper?
Oh my gosh, it's only a limit of time. I've got all of these inspiring ideas of things to write, and there's never a shortage. So yes, definitely.
That's exciting. That's really exciting.
My problem is not thinking up the ideas. My problem is having the time to get them down on paper and edit it and all that.
Okay.
Well, how do you make each book new and fresh? Because you're dealing with a very similar subject with each one.
Well, you know, my thinking on the topics moves on by itself. I don't have to nudge it at all. I get new ideas on how to better, I guess is the best way to say it. And, you know, I can't wait to get him out there. So, yeah, I find that it's not hard. In fact, that I try to have as little overlap as possible, because I see so many books out there where they take sort of a formula approach and they just kind of twist the information three or four different ways each time the book comes out. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I've been a little cheated when I see that. And, but this is not that. This is, each time I'm able to come up with some brand new material, so I'm happy about that.
Well, Caroline, how did Michael's suggestions about to-do lists, how did it influence you?
Well, right away, in the first part of the book, he has his now task list, his opportunity now, and over the horizon. And I make a list every day of things I want to do. Although I don't work in a job, I have 2 radio shows a week, and I volunteer at the hospital some, and I play at church and so forth and so on.
Play piano
at church. Yeah, right. Yeah. And I have study groups at church. So I have to keep things organized or I forget to do things. And because I'm 74 years old? Yeah, soon be 75. So anyway, this was great. This was great because the now task lists are things that I need to do today. The opportunity now are things I need to have done, but they're not critical. The now list is critical. And then the over the horizon list are things that I want to do, and it's great to list them because I think of that and then I forget it. But if I write it on this over the horizon list, there it is, and I can, you know, I can remember, yeah, I need to do that. I just really was really tickled with that.
So, Michael, is this something that is new in this book?
Yes, it is. It's the idea of doing it on paper, or you can do it in a Microsoft Word document, you can do it in an Excel document, that's all new. I did use similar concepts and applied them to Microsoft Outlook in some previous books. But, you know, not everybody uses Outlook, not everybody wants to use the computer to manage their tasks, they like to use paper lists. So I adapted it for paper and other approaches. And it really is a powerful technique. It's amazing how badly people manage their to-do lists. I mean, you write it down and you think, oh good, it's under control, and then you look at your list one day and you go, oh my gosh, it's so big, and the list becomes a problem in itself. You know, you don't even want to look at it after a while. And so this approach I use kind of matches the psychology of most people. I did a lot of research with my clients and myself, I guess I could say, on how I and others react to, you know, the stress of work and the stress of tasks, and how we tend to focus on some and how we tend to avoid others, and came up with a really nice approach that feels really natural to most people. I think is it Carol? Is that
Caroline?
Caroline said it's a real natural approach. And I'd be happy to go over it in more detail if we have time on the call.
Yeah, it really is. But I find this when I have to do several errands away from home, I write down which is first, the closest, and so forth, and write them so that I don't forget to do something as I'm going around, because, you know, things happen and think, oh, well, I can do that another time. But if it's on my list, I think, no, this has to be done now. And
well, my business partner and I have a kind of a unique approach to to-do lists, because often what happens, you get to the end of the day and nothing on your list is checked off. So what we do is then go back and write down the things we did and check them off so that we feel good about
it. Oh, that's a good one. I like that.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I'll have to remember that one.
I'm going to use that.
So you can give credit to Margie Wood for that one. So,
okay.
Michael, why don't you go into a little more detail about this process?
I will. It's really so intuitive and it's so easy, and yet when people do it, they go, oh, my gosh, this really works. So let's talk about it. I find that the thing in a busy work environment, and I think even out there in Fairfield, Iowa, where there are people in busy work environments, everywhere we find this, I find that what tends to go wrong, what tends to cause people to accumulate so much stress and feel like they're not getting things done, is that when we get behind on things, and believe me, these days you will get behind because you just get so many things and so many emails and so many requests. So when you start to get behind, you start to feel guilty. You start to feel slightly fearful, like, oh, I'm not keeping up with my responsibilities. And then what happens after that is everything begins to feel urgent. Everything, and you get yourself whipped up into this kind of what I call workday froth, where everything seems urgent, and you just jump on everything that comes in front of you because you just feel like if you could only work faster, you could get it done, and you'll just do everything as fast as you can. But you're never going to get it all done. So the better approach is this. Identify those things that absolutely must be done today. And when I say that, I really do mean that. I mean, use what I call the going home test. Ask yourself, if this thing were not done by the end of the day, would I stay up all night to complete it? And if the answer is no, I would not stay at work. I would not go home. Then don't write it on the list. Only put things there that you really must do today, and put them in the top section that Carolyn called or mentioned already. It's called the critical now. It's called the critical now section of this little paper to-do list. You can take out a single two pieces of paper. At the top, write critical now, and just in that top third of that first page, put those things that absolutely must be done today. And using that going home test, there's usually only a couple items that really have to be done that you would, stay up all night to work on. Then in the next section, which is one third of the way down, write the word the phrase opportunity now, and in that section, start listing those things that you would work if you had the opportunity to do them today. And so that could be something that, is really important but not important enough to stay all night. Or it might be something that you just really, really like to do, that's kind of fun to do, that you really hope to get to. Anything like that qualifies. And put things in that section that, you may not get till tomorrow or the next day or the next day. They're all eligible to do today, but you just, realize you may not get to all of them, but you kind of want them in your sight in case you have the opportunity to get to them, and that's what that second part of that list is. Those two things together, just having that list together, clearly identifying what it is that's going to come haunt you if you don't get them done, and those things that you'd like to do, having those two things delineated is really useful. And then there's the third section. Should I talk about the third section?
Oh, yes.
Do you have any questions on that?
No, go ahead and talk about the third section.
Okay. And then the third section is really designed to help keep the first list, the first two sections, short. Because what happens is we get these inspirations, I want to do X, Y, Z, I want to do this. But they're not really necessary to do this week, but you don't want to lose them. Yeah. And if you put them down in your main list, the main list is going to get really cluttered. So I have this thing called the Over the Horizon list. And that's the second page. The whole second page is for this thing called the Over the Horizon list. And there just list things that you probably aren't going to get to for, and the key cutoff is a week and a half, and I may have time to talk about why that cutoff is so important. But the key cutoff is a week and a half, and anything later that you can get to later than a week and a half or more, months even, right there. And then put that list in your top desk drawer and don't look at it for another week. The idea is to get these things off your main list so your main list isn't so cluttered and overwhelming. Get them away. And, this may include some things that you'd kind of like to get to this week, but you're probably not going to because you've got so many other things going on. So put them on that list. Get them off your main list so you can get your main list down to a nice, reasonable size that you can study, easily several times a day without feeling, nervous about it.
Michael, why a week and a half?
Okay. I knew you were going to ask that. There's this very interesting phenomenon. It's a psychological phenomenon that I've discovered. Maybe somebody else has discovered it well, but I haven't seen it written up anywhere else. And that's that. And let me tell a story about this. When I go into the seminars and my speeches that I give, I ask this following question. I say, okay, I want everybody to consider the following. If a colleague of yours, not your boss, and not even a colleague you particularly care about, but just somebody who...
Some non-entity.
Yeah, you happen to work with, comes to you and says, hey, I've got this really neat half-day project. Wouldn't you love to do it? And you look at it and say, hey, it is kind of a fun project. It does look kind of interesting. And they say, fine, it's due today. Get it done. Would you drop everything and do it? And I suspect the answer would be no. And I ask the crowd, and they all say, no, of course we wouldn't do it. We've got tons of work to do. We can't drop everything for somebody else's project. And then I say, okay, but it is a fun project. It's a really fun project. They still say, no, we're not, we're busy. All right, then I pose the question, all right, raise your hand if you would do it in 2 months. And all the hands go up. They say, yeah, fun project. I can certainly fit in a half-day project in 2 months. And then I say, all right, well, what about, and then I start negotiating. Okay, what about 1 month? And almost all the hands still stay up. And I say, fine, what about 3 weeks? And all the hands are still up. What about 2 weeks? All the hands are still up. What about 1 week? Almost all the hands go down. Mm. Now, at 2 weeks, a couple hands go down. But in between 1 week and 2 weeks, there's this thing that I have come to call the workday now horizon. It's the time period where we stop worrying about our tasks if they're beyond that time. It's like it's out of sight, out of mind, if they're beyond this workday now horizon.
Mm-hmm.
So if they're beyond about a week and a half, most of us stop worrying about what's on our list. If it's inside a week and a half, we feel a little bit freaked out about it. We feel anxious about it. We feel like it's going to contribute to our sense of being overwhelmed. And so I sort of use that psychology in reverse. I say, okay, in order to reduce the anxiousness that you feel about what's on your plate right now, find as many items you can and toss them over that workday now horizon. Get them out beyond a week and a half. And it works. It works. It sounds kind of, tricky. It sounds like you're trying to trick yourself, but it actually works. It greatly reduces the sense of stress that people have about their overload at work. And it's written on a list that you're going to check every week, so if something becomes more urgent, once you check it, you can move it up to the front page if you need to. But what I discover, a lot of people say, well, aren't you just procrastinating? And I say no, because what I discover is that most tasks, if you let them sit, most non-critical tasks, if you let them sit for a little bit, become a lot less important and a lot less important. And I found the half-life of tasks is very, very short.
And sometimes you can defer doing something long enough that it doesn't have to be done at all.
That's right. Now, you may think that's being irresponsible, but believe me, it's really what's going on there is that our priorities change, our boss's priorities change. We get all excited about it. In fact, there's a whole book written on this called "Do It Tomorrow" by Mark Forster, a British author. And he says there's this side of our psychology that's called the reactive mind that tends to overreact to events and create more work than has to be done for ourselves because we overreact. And his whole thing, that's why he called it "Do It Tomorrow." He said, always give the test of time to these assignments that you give yourself, because in most cases their importance will almost disappear once you give it a little time.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can get things off of our plate through a simple test like that, then more power to us, isn't it?
Of course, for me, it's a bit of a problem because most of my tasks are related to IRS deadlines as a tax accountant.
So I'm here. Yeah, well, that's
they
unavoidable.
They do not change. Yeah, they do not change.
Yeah, and I agree, that part of the problem with not thinking about things that have that longer horizon is that I end up at every deadline being
overwhelmed,
yeah.
Well, don't put anything that is right up against a deadline. Just put something there that can wait, and then when you review it, if your deadline looks closer, move it back out to, your critical now list if it has to be done.
Right, right. But, of course, I have to think about how many things can be done. I mean, the deadline might be April 15th, but if I have 3 weeks of work that has a deadline of April 15th, I have to make earlier deadlines on some of those things.
Absolutely, and that's another thing. There's an author named David Allen who writes about productivity, and one of his main recommendations that I wholeheartedly endorse is this idea of identifying the next action of every larger task, chunk it down into smaller pieces and find the very next action that needs to be done and write that down in your to-do list. You'll find that it's much more actionable and it gets you along closer to your goal more quickly.
Can that be referred to as the critical path, maybe?
What was that?
Can that be referred to as critical path?
That's one way to describe it. That's the project management term, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just his term is next action. He calls it next action.
Okay, yeah.
Well, you're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Michael Linenberger, author of Master Your Workday Now, Proven Strategies to Control Chaos, Create Outcomes, and Connect Your Work to Who You Really Are. So, Michael, let's talk a little bit about connecting your work to who you really are.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
We had a guest a couple weeks ago, Jeff Klein, author of Working for Good, who and one of the founders of Conscious Capitalism.
I love it.
Yeah.
Oh, it was great. It was just great.
So that was really the theme of that interview, but it sounds like you have some words of wisdom about this, too.
Well, I do. If you look at my book, I've got these three levels that I think everybody should take when they go go after what I call workday mastery. Workday mastery. Workday mastery is just, let's just say it's a holistic success at work. And the three levels are control, create, and connect. And control is what we were just talking about. I think people need to get their urgency under control, because if they don't, they get locked in this sort of fearful state where they're feeling like they're behind all the time. And the fearful, anxious state, or even just, you know, uncomfortable state, is not really conducive, I think, to creative thinking and to very productive thinking. I find that my best work, particularly in writing, but even in more mundane things, happens when I have a more creative energy, a more positive energy behind what I'm doing. So absolutely, get control of your out-of-control workday first, so the control layer first, then work at the create layer, which is creating your goals. It's how to create goals. It's using positive approaches to creating goals. And then the next layer is what I call the connect layer, and that is once you've got those two layers under your belt, I really think that people ought to take a broader look at why they're working in the jobs they are. Do they enjoy their work? Do the jobs fulfill them? And my goal for everyone is to connect their work to who they really are, to find a way to connect their work to who they really are. Because, you know, you spend 8-10 hours a day, 5 days a week or more at work, and why live so much time in a disconnected state from the priorities and the values and the inspirations that you have? Now, that doesn't mean you have to, you know, quit your job right now and go out and start a business that completely aligns with your goals and values. But it does mean start looking in the direction of seeing how the work that you're doing lines up with what I call a larger purpose or vision that you can find for yourself and your work. I really do hope that everyone has a chance to find what a larger purpose or vision in their work that their work is contributing to, and that they then start to connect their enthusiasm and their values with life to that, and through that to the work that they do.
You know, if they never thought about that, if they never envisioned that, and they feel sort of uneasy that they're not really happy, but they think if they stop and took a look at it, there might be areas of that work that they could incorporate into their values, or maybe you have to change a little bit yourself. You know, it's not impossible to change yourself sometimes, and right? That can work too, you know. But I'm
all about, you know, once I get my day under control, I try to focus on the visions that I have, and I encourage everyone to find vision. In fact, you know, that's my approach to goals is focusing on vision. We may have time to talk about that, but I hope that everyone finds time to focus on their vision and then to develop their vision larger so that it becomes a source of inspiration. You know, and obviously we may have multiple visions of how we would like our life to be, but you know, it's interesting because sometimes people tell me, though, I hate my work. I don't see anything good that's going on in my work. I want to find something more positive. And I have discovered that if you ask your leadership in your company to see the vision statement of the company, you may be very, very surprised what you find. Every company has a vision statement. They just may not promulgate them to their employees, or they may not have shown it to anybody for a while, but almost every company does have a vision statement, and it's usually very positive. It's usually very global and very, you know, uplifting, and shows a lot of all the good things that the company has in mind. You know, sometimes they're written under just because they have to, and the marketing department writes them, but usually they're written with a lot of sincerity. And you'd be surprised what your company actually stands for and hopes to achieve. And if you can get behind that vision in your own heart, I think it'll make your success and enjoyment of work much, much better.
And you might find that that this business is taking a deviation, going down the wrong path. Maybe you can bring it back to the original concept too.
Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, if there's nothing more sort of surprising in a positive way for management when they see their own staff starting to adopt the vision of their company, and then perhaps even bringing the senior management back into alignment with the vision, because they get really busy and they forget what it is that they're there to do, and sometimes can slip off their own goals and their own vision. And yeah, you're absolutely right.
Now, Michael, you say that goal setting in the corporate environment is in a fatally flawed state. What do you mean by that?
Oh, boy. I feel pretty passionate about this. I don't know what it's like in the company that the listeners, you know, I'm sure there's a whole bunch of different company or, you know, work situations. But in most of the companies that I've been in, what happens is every quarter or every 6 months, they come to all the employees and say, hey, you guys need to set your goals for the year or for the quarter or for the half year. And these are the goals that we think you ought to go after. I mean, they actually give you your own goals, and then they say, now go do them. And it, to me, that's such an abuse of the word goal. First of all, you know, to me, a goal should be something that's an inner drive to better yourself, to achieve more, to excel, to expand your horizons, to experience more, to do more. Goals should be a source of inspiration and enthusiasm for you. But if they're thrusted upon you by somebody else, if you don't own them personally, there's no way you can do that. And yet that's what seems to happen so often in the corporate environment. Plus, you know, then it becomes a kind of a stick, right? It becomes a stick. Yeah, if you don't get this goal, you're not going to get your bonus and you're a bad person. And boy, there's no, in my mind, there's no better way to kill our connection to an enthusiastic goal than to do something like that. So yeah, I really, unfortunately, most companies really abuse the approach to goals and the term goals, and I hope I can change some of that by teaching other ways to accomplish goals and to think about goals.
I think sometimes setting goals can be overemphasized, because sometimes if you specify a goal, then you become rigidly attached to that particular goal. And like you say, it's similar with the time, you know, with postponing tasks, where your priorities change. You need to be constantly rethinking
Absolutely. The
goal.
Absolutely. That's right. See, I counsel my clients and everybody who reads my books to create what I call a vision statement for your goal, and then attach, you know, in that vision statement, try to capture in those words, in those few words, the emotions and the enthusiasm of obtaining that goal. And then I actually go through a process I call goal activation, where I have people read that vision statement and feel, you know, actually feel those sensations of enthusiasm and what it feels like to have obtained the goal, because that's what really adds the juice to goals. And I say, if you do that and after a while it doesn't work anymore, the goal doesn't get you excited anymore, then it's time to move on. Mm. You know, you've lost the juice for that goal. It doesn't really excite you anymore. Then that's not your goal anymore. You need find the next one, find the bigger one.
And that doesn't mean you failed.
No, absolutely not. It means you moved on, right?
And in this book, of course, you take readers through a series of exercises to match their career goals to life goals, which is...
I do. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So many people, when I say, you know, find a vision or purpose that of what you want at your work, find a job, and then I say, I advise them, and then write up a statement that describes what would be, quote, your life's work, and then, you know, activate that, find the enthusiasm in it, and find the ways to become excited about it, and then that'll help you chase it down. Well, a lot of people say, well, I don't know what I want to do. I'm not sure what I want to do. I can't decide. And so I've got some exercises in the book that will help you identify what an ideal job would be for you. And they're fairly simple, to have you go over your life experiences and find either work, usually work experiences, but it could be volunteer experiences, it could be other activities that are work-like, or even hobbies that really make you happy, that really ring your bell, that really, you know, turn you on. And take those and use that to help come up with your life's work vision statement. So yeah, there's a good exercise in there for that.
And for most people, you don't have to decide just once what you want to do with your life.
Oh, that is such a cool statement. I'm so glad you said that.
Yeah,
many
right.
people, you know, we've got this misunderstanding that when you're in high school, you're supposed to pick what your major is, and when you're in college, you're supposed to pick what your profession is, and then you're supposed to do it, and that's it for the rest of your life. And I so disagree with that. I'm so glad you said that. I think it's always going to be a moving target. You know, we have these experiences at work. We then, in those experiences, see more things that we want to do. and will create a new vision of a new life's work. And you know, this really applies to me. I've changed careers about 5 times just because I wanted to. I loved going on to the new things, and everyone should be open to that.
Why is there such a fear of that? Is it because they don't want to leave the job they have in case they might not get another one? Of course, in today's economy, I can understand that.
Yeah, I think it's fear. I really do. I think it's fear that they won't, you know, that they won't succeed in making the transition. They become comfortable uh-huh. where they are. They've got all this network of friends and people and yeah. colleagues and skills, and that they'll have to start over again. But it's a lot easier than you think. And I think that if you have the enthusiasm behind a new role, that enthusiasm will carry you so much farther than the network of people that you have in your current job. In fact, if you're unhappy with your job, you're gonna find yourself out of a job fast, because the unhappiness will affect your performance, will affect your attitude, it'll affect the way people perceive you. I think that if you're unhappy with your job, it does you really, really good credit to go find a bigger vision. And it could be within your company, but just find a way to become happy.
I remember when I was teaching school, telling kids, you know, when you're young, try different things. Try different jobs. Because when you get older, of course, if you change jobs too often, that's detrimental to your resume. But when you're young, you can do that. And then, you have these
that's
different...
That's absolutely true.
Yeah.
And I would say that these days, changing jobs is not as bad as it used to be in the old days.
Ah.
Because it's more that these days you take on a career and you take that career with you from company to company. That's often very common, and a lot of companies do expect that. I know when I was a vice president at Accenture, and when I looked at resumes, if I saw somebody who had been in their job for 15 years, I said, wow, why didn't they move around and try different things? it made me wonder.
Well, I had a good example growing up of someone who wasn't afraid to make midlife career changes in my father,
yeah.
who, when I was in high school, went down to part-time in his job as a civil engineer, and started an organic produce production farm, basically. And then he started a sprout equipment manufacturing business. And he also tried to make a living as an artist briefly, and was also doing a lot of work in theater. And this was
he was a master woodworker, which he tried before the engineering thing. He graduated as a mechanical engineer from Cornell University, and then went to work out in California as a civil engineer in the mountains. Surveying for roads, and we had quite a varied life. And then moved back to Pennsylvania, was civil engineer there for a while. But he was so talented. He was so multi-talented that he had to try different things.
And the thing is, if he hadn't done that, you know, he had 5 kids at home when he basically quit his job, and that might seem like a really strange thing to do, but if he hadn't done it then, he would not have had the opportunity to because he passed away very suddenly at age 49.
Boy.
So, yeah. So, for me, the lesson in that was, boy, do it now, because you don't know.
You just don't know.
You don't know you're going to be able to do it in the future.
Right. Follow your passion.
Yeah, yeah. I had something that I was leading to, and now I forget what it was. But I will say that you're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Michael Lindenberger, author of Master Your Workday Now. And now I remember where I was going. So in that story of our family history, we did move to Fairfield, and that's because of the farm that he bought nearby and wanted to grow organic produce mm-hmm. and so forth. And I understand, Michael, that you used to live in Fairfield.
I lived in Fairfield for 2 years back in 1982 to 1984.
Wow.
I did. Yes, I came there because of all that hoopla around the World Peace Movement. I was very much supporting that and thought it was a great thing and came to support it. Yeah, it was wonderful.
When you were here, what kind of work were you doing?
Well, it's funny that you say that because I was a civil engineer.
I saw that. He was a civil engineer in his bio, yeah.
That was my first. I had just graduated from grad school, in civil engineering, and I started a little company with 2 other civil engineers there in Fairfield.
Wow.
And we did some work, and then I got married and moved to San Diego and joined a big civil engineering company.
Uh-huh.
Now, have you been back to Fairfield since?
Oh, I've visited. I have visited. I haven't done more than that. I think I hadn't been there for over 7 or 8 years, and then I went to visit about a year ago.
Okay. I was going to say, things have changed a lot recently.
Yes, they certainly have, in a good way.
Yeah. What did you notice when you were here most recently?
It looks smaller. Don't people always say that when they come back to a town that they used to live in? It looks smaller. No, it looked so much more. I don't know. I just thought they'd done a really good job on the square. It looked really nicely done.
Looks more cosmopolitan,
doesn't it? The campus looked different.
Mm-hmm,
I was impressed.
And the artistic community has really grown here, the cultural community. We have a lot of...
I've heard.
The business community is also very strong. So
yeah, really.
We have a lot of pluses here.
You mentioned, talked about email briefly a little bit ago. Is there a way for people to get their email reined in? Because I know that's a big problem for some
people. Yeah, I have very distinct recommendations about email. So a lot of people think their email is out of control because they get too much spam or get too much unnecessary CC'd mail from people. My clear observation is that, no, it's the mail that matters that bogs down your inbox. It's the mail that has something for you to do, and you don't have time to do it right at the moment. And so you leave it in your inbox thinking you're going to come back to it.
Mm.
But you know what happens. It just scrolls down off the bottom of your inbox, and as more mail comes in, and then you get this huge mess of what I call unreconciled actions. They're actions that you know you want to work on, but that creates a huge problem because you have to open all the mail, individual emails, to find those actions. The subject line often has nothing to do with what the action request is, so you're rereading all this mail, and it's in chronological order. It's not in importance order, and it's just a mess. And so what I've discovered is the problem, the solution to this problem is task management. The email problem is really a task management problem, and we just talked about how to solve your to-do list, which is task management. You know, you divide your to-dos into these three zones. I call those zones, by the way, urgency zones. So critical now, opportunity now, and over the horizon. And I say do that with email. As email comes in, if you identify an action to do, and, you know, one out of every certain number of emails will have an action for you, if you identify that, then, you know, other than a quick reply, if it's a quick reply, you can do it in 10 seconds, just do it real fast and get rid of it. But other than that, if it has a little bit longer action for you to do, then convert it to a task. And there's a whole bunch of different ways to do that, depending on what kind of email system you have. If you have Outlook, it takes a half a second. You just drag the email to the task icon, and it turns into a task. And I show people how to set up their Outlook system to match these three urgency zones that I just said. And so now the tension is removed from your inbox, and you've got it in a system, a task system, where you can manage it appropriately. You'd be amazed. Once you do that, once you convert emails to tasks like that, it removes the tension from the inbox. You can finally file away all your email. I empty my inbox every day. Most of my clients, after they take my classes, empty their inboxes every day. And it feels so good. It just feels so good to empty your inbox. And it's not just an emotion. It's a tangible increase in productivity because you're not bogged down by all this old mail where you've got mixed feelings about it. Oh, I should go through and find these things. I should do this. I should do that. It's just once you convert them to tasks, you're in a system where you can manage them, and it works.
That's my
solution.
Organization.
I'm going to have to try that one for sure.
Yeah. Now, if you don't have Outlook,
I do.
You do. Okay. Good. If you got Gmail or something like that, then put your three zone list in Microsoft Word, and then just copy the URL from the message in there. If you want to go find the mail message later when you work on the task. Usually why people save the message. They think they're going to need to look at it again when they work on the task. So I say just copy the link over there and then file your mail away, and Gmail would be the archive folder, and Outlook you can set up folders. Just get it out of your inbox.
Well, Michael, before we run out of time today, would you like to read a section from Master Your Workday Now?
Yeah, you know, I thought about that, and the section I'm going to read is actually the very last part of the book. And the reason I chose this is because, for practical reasons, much of my book is very, very step-by-step. This is how to, you know, do this, this is how to do that, and it's very, very practical, and it unfortunately, it doesn't read that well to an audience. in terms of being, you know, sort of inspiring. But the very last section is, I find, I like a lot. It's very inspiring, and it reads well. And so it has to do with, you know, after you've done all these things that, you know, you get your life in control, your work day in control, so the control, create, connect, you know, do you just stop? Okay, my work day is in control. What do I do now? Well, I want to encourage people to keep moving. Think of bigger things. Think of more inspiring things to go after. And so this section is called Thinking Big, and it's just a two or three pages. Does that fit in your time frame?
Sounds great.
Okay, very good. So this is it's the conclusion to the book. It's called Thinking Big, and I say this. In part three, you learned the last step of gaining workday mastery. You learned how to find a vision or purpose larger than yourself, and you learned how to turn that into a current life works vision statement, a statement you are activating in your daily Now Goal activation sessions. Doing this and then attaining your current life's work role represents the top level of the workday mastery pyramid. That's the connect layer. This section then concludes with a look at personal mission, how it's a useful thing to consider. And even though we close with mission, I feel the primary focus for most of our visioning work should not be on writing a mission statement. I think it should be on identifying your current larger vision or purpose for work and driving that forward into your next vision of life and life's work activity. And then the next, and then the next. Don't worry if you can't call it your permanent mission. Just keep advancing it. Life is all about experiencing more and more, expanding your abilities, and fulfilling more of your inner and outer visions. For many of us, that may show up as more personal or material improvement, or improvement for our families. If you are deeply religious or spiritual, it may be about service to humanity or getting closer to God. It may be about expanding your learning, your knowledge. Whatever your largest visions may be, keep marching forward towards those larger goals. Keep creating even larger goals as you go so that they consistently pull you forward, and think as big as you can each step of the way. Thinking big is important. I was once told that to set my larger vision, I should pick the biggest thing I really wanted and then stop and ask myself, how can I make it even bigger? In fact, one of my favorite exercises is to take a moment and ask myself this: what would I do if I knew I could do anything and not fail? Think about that.
I just saw that on the cup today.
What would you do? What would you envision if you knew you could not fail? What vision would you create for yourself? For example, the last time I asked myself this question, I decided I wanted to create a university to train business people on the ideas in this book and related material, a university that nearly all businesses would send their staff to. Now, I don't see a practical way to do that right now, or even for that matter, or ever for that matter. Starting a full-fledged university is a big feat, especially for one of such quality that all would want to attend. It is several levels beyond anything I had in mind for the future. But that moment of my ignoring all roadblocks and instead imagining it as if it were done, and myself in that vision, had a remarkably liberating effect. It connected me with some inner creative knowing I didn't realize I had, and for a moment, I rose above all my current restrictive beliefs, and I actually felt what life would feel like if those restrictions were gone. That felt very good, and that flash of inspiration has affected me positively ever since. So, what would you do if you knew you could do anything and not fail? How are we on time?
Yeah, we're good. Now, also, you have this statement in that chapter. Think of this. Everything that humanity has created in this world was an idea first, a vision first.
Yes, at the very end of that section. And isn't that a wonderful statement? Let me find that. One parting thought. Yeah. Remember, it is all about vision. Think of this statement. Everything that humanity has created in the world was an idea first, a vision first. Everything starts as a flash of inspiration. What does that tell you about the power of vision? Don't discount your dreams. Rather, embrace them and think of the possibilities that exist in those imaginings. Write them down, adjust your beliefs so you can believe in them, and then go after them. Activate them in your daily goal sessions and look for an even larger you to emerge.
Thank you, Michael. That was Michael Linenberger reading from Master Your Workday Now. It's such a coincidence, because that phrase, the what...
What would you do if you knew you could not fail?
Yeah, I just saw that on a mug in Revelations bookstore today at lunch.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
I know I'm not the first one to say this.
You know, there are people, and I'm one of them, that I think, okay, I'm going to do this, and then before I get there, I see something else that has to be done, and then I see something else that has to be done. This is just in my house, okay?
Yeah.
You know, and I read an editorial about that. It was very funny, and it fit me perfectly because that happens.
Yeah.
Well, and then I forget what the first thing was.
I think we do get distracted. I really do. And it's not, you know, distractions, they just kind of lower our quality of life. We just kind of get a little less interested and a little less interested, and before you know it, we're not really happy with our life. And that's why I say, you know, make some time every day. I call this thing this goal activation. I actually have another word for it, goal spinning, where I say take the goal and just kind of spin it up in your mind. Just sort of think of the goal from different way, different perspectives, and imagine and visualize yourself as if you already had the goal. And just, I do that every day with my major goals, once a day, just before I go to bed. And it's amazing how just once a day that will keep the goal active in your awareness. And even if it's just in your subconscious, then you're less likely to get distracted because there's this little thought kind of spinning in the back of your head. Oh, I kind of wanted to do this. This is what I want to achieve. This is what I want. And then you tend to favor those activities which help you get that goal. And so, yeah, just a little attention on your goals once a day does a remarkable thing.
Well, Michael, I have a few questions about your writing process and how you found your publisher and so things like that.
Sure.
Do you enjoy writing for its own sake, or do you do it just to get the knowledge out?
I think that if I knew that the knowledge would not get out, that I would not write. So I do enjoy writing, but I think I enjoy writing because I know I'm going to get the knowledge out.
Mm.
Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Now, when you were working on this book, did you have to do a lot of research, or did you already have all the knowledge and information from your work?
Yeah, the latter. See, I only write about things that I already know about, or that I, you know, I'm already doing, or that I'm already having success with. Now, every once in a while, in order to complete an article or to complete a chapter, there might be a piece that I haven't tried yet, and then I'll go off and do some research to sort of fill it out. But no, I write from experience and from my own inspirations, as opposed to going out and trying to find it and then writing about it.
Now, when you're writing a book, are you doing that full time, or are you still doing your workshops and seminars at the same time?
Yeah, my process is as follows. I will for quite a length of time start collecting ideas, and I jot them down as I get them. I carry a notebook with me. Some of my best ideas are when I'm outdoors or when I'm hiking. I always carry a little pocket notebook with me and write them down. And then I put them into my computer. I use a program called Mind Manager. You may have heard of that. And I throw them in there. I throw them in OneNote on the computer. And then over time, the ideas will gel enough that I start to see a theme that could become a book or become a chapter of a book or a section of a book. And in some cases, the book idea is already there, and I'm looking for those ideas. In other cases, I'm writing things down, not knowing how I'm going to use them, and then they come together and they fit into something. So during that time, I might be working. I'm often working on, you know, client work or doing seminars, things like that. And then I finally get to that point where I make the decision, okay, this book has to happen. In fact, what I do, just to give myself a little bit of a jump start, is I'll set the date that I want to publish it by. And that's not just an arbitrary decision. It's because publishers and distributors need to know well in advance, 9 months or more in advance, when the book's going to get released. So in some cases, 2 years in advance if it's a big publisher. So you got to set the date. And then I kind of back from that date and say, okay, I better get started writing because I have to get this stuff all together. And depending on how the deadline's going, I might stop my seminars and my client work because I need to focus more on the book. But oftentimes I can fit them both in.
Wow. About how long, you say you want to write a book every 2 years, so are you spending all of that time either thinking about what to write next or writing?
Yeah, No, not at all. I'm collecting through my work and through my just, you know, looking for ideas. I'm collecting notes, but it's also regular work that I'm doing.
Right.
And then something starts to gel. You know, it's funny because I didn't set a goal to do a book every 2 years or less. It's just been working out that way because that's kind of when the ideas come together and then say, okay, they're ready to be written down. Now, there are some dates that get to, for instance, my Outlook book, my Microsoft Outlook book. It's been the number one best-selling Outlook book for 4 years now. It, when Microsoft upgrades to another system of Outlook, I have to get out and write another book. So sometimes I'm driven to get the new versions out. But normally, I just use my own kind of time frame.
Now, one of the most fascinating parts of nonfiction writing is determining how a book is going to be structured. Chapters, sections, you know, you have all this information, but there's a million different ways to organize it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
What's your process like in determining how to organize and structure the finished product?
Well, you know, I pick something, I go for it, and then I see how it sticks. And that's why I write my entire book almost down to the paragraph level in that program I mentioned, Mind Manager. It's this kind of visual outlining tool. I write everything in there, if you're in that kind of a program, you could use a super outlining program as well, but I don't like the linear approach. Mind Manager has a sort of radial spatial approach, which I like a lot more. You can see the big sections, you can see the subsections, you can see everything, and I can kind of constantly, as I'm writing, I'm constantly stepping back and says, how does this fit into the big picture? How does this fit? And, you know, right up until, you know, the last minute, I am moving sections around a lot because I want to make sure the flow, you know, a nonfiction doesn't normally have a story, but it can have a story, you know, and I want to make sure the flow of the story feels right. And sometimes it keeps bugging me, and I'll say, no, that needs to go somewhere else, and I can move entire sections around and restructure a book right up into the last, you know. Then the problem with that, of course, is you have to redo transitions. But it's, yeah, I leave it pretty fluid until I really like what I see, and sometimes it sticks, sometimes it doesn't.
Now, I haven't heard of that program, Mind Manager, before.
That's great.
Yeah.
I have a lot of recently I made a lot of author friends, and I'm turning them all onto it, and they're loving it.
Where do you find it?
Oh, you can get it on Amazon. It's really well-known, Mind Manager, amongst, you know, certain groups anyway. Right. Mind Manager, you can get it on Amazon. You can go right out to mindjet.com and get it. It's a little expensive. It's like about $300, but it's really very powerful.
Well, there's so much information in your book, and I'm sure books similar, that I would think it'd be hard to organize things. But as you say, you just you move things around until you've got what you want.
And how do you know when it's done?
Yes, how do you know?
Well, some people would say when the deadline has arrived. And, you know, I like that phrase. There's some phrase that said you never stop writing, you just stop editing. I think that's the word. I think that's something like that.
Mm-hmm.
There is a point, though, when I kind of get this little click, when I feel like, wow, this has come together. I've got what I want to say down. And unfortunately, though, and I'm sure you're aware of this too, anybody who's written, you know, you see these movies where, you know, the writer who's trying to write this book and he's having a challenge, and there's all this drama around the challenge, and finally at the end of the movie he plops down this 6-inch thick manuscript on the publisher's desk and everybody applauds to an end, you know. And the thing that any writer knows is that is not the end of the process. You're about at 20% when you do that. You know, when you drop that, particularly a nonfiction book, when you drop that manuscript down at a desk, that's about the 20% point. There is so much more to do after that, the editing and the rewriting and the, you know, and then I own my own publishing company, and so I do a lot of the publishing work myself, and that's a ton of work.
Oh, yeah.
And so...
When do you sleep? When do you sleep?
No, it's never done until the book's out the door, and you're never happy until the third edition, you know?
Yeah.
Well, we're just about out of time, Michael. Where can listeners find out more about your work?
Go to this following website, masteryourworkday.com, masteryourworkday.com, where this book that we're talking about, the Master Your Workday Now book, this is the launch week, and we're having all this hoopla and promotions and all, you know, we're giving away a lot of free gifts out there. if you buy the book and just put the order number in, you can even buy it on Amazon, just put the order in. You'll get lots of free tools, and there's a drawing for some laptops and all this. So it's all exciting.
Yeah.
Go out there. And by the way, it's really, Amazon put the book on sale for some reason this week. It's $11. Really inexpensive.
Wow.
Right now, so this is the time
wow.
to buy it. So
that is
MasterYourWorkDay.com.
That's a great buy.
Well, thank you so much for being with us on Writer's Voices.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
And let us know when your next book comes out.
I will. I'll give you a heads up.
Okay. I want him to hear my outtake
here.
Because
closing quote.
Yeah, this is a little different. By the way, that other quote was Robert Schuller was attributed to that other quote about what would you do if you knew you could not fail.
So he originated it?
Apparently, yeah.
I've seen it quoted many times, but nobody attributed
yeah.
it.
Okay, good. So the one I have today is, the work will wait while you show the kids the rainbow, but the rainbow won't wait while you finish the work.
Oh, that is so good. I love it.
Now, before we close, I want to mention that one of our previous guests, Michael Murphy, will be offering his Writing as a Sacred Practice workshop on four almost consecutive Sunday afternoons beginning March 14th. The seminar will take place at the newly opened Flying Leap Art Space, 54.5 North Main on the Square. The purpose of the seminar is to enable participants to discover a deeper level of truth in the events of their lives. And for more information, visit www.dawnhawk.com, dawnhawk.com, and see you next week on Writer's Voices.
From the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.